private opinions about the advisability, worth of the Vietnam enterprise? Or pretty private opinions that differed from the official one?
That's another question you're going to have to ask him, because he's very good at answering that.
Is it the kind of thing that naval officers will talk about privately among each other, among themselves, or is it kind of a tacit agreement not to discuss such things?
No, everybody has his own opinion. If you're ordered to go over there and do your job, you go over there and do your job. But everybody has his, and I don't think that anybody who's ever been in Vietnam fails to see a reason for helping the South Vietnamese. The question is whether this is something that's such a responsibility of this country that you want to sink that much resource into it. Once you're over there and you know the resource being sunk into it, it's pretty obvious that you're really helping some people in a bad situation. Mm-hmm. Now, they've been fighting now close to 30 years. Yeah. And but whether or not it's the policy of the country to utilize that much resource over there, that's up pretty much up to the administration. But you have your own ideas as to whether it's good or bad. I think that you'll get this best from Admiral Zumwalt.
Sure.
I think the position that he took was maybe it could have been avoided. And maybe we should not have gotten into the situation where we were expending that much resource. But having gotten into it, there was no way that you could just precipitously pull out. And it had to be settled in such a way that South Vietnam was strong. And so he was very much dedicated to holding the line and pushing the enemy back while strengthening the South Vietnamese. And this was kind of a two-pronged portion of the mission that he set up for himself when he went over there. And this gets me now into, I think, the Vietnam story as I see it. He asked me to come over because he wanted some officer to, a captain, to maybe build up a little bit the operations analysis group that was over there. There was a small group of four or five officers working directly for the commander of the naval forces. Hmm. Which we will abbreviate as CONNAV-4B.
Sounds just as long, right?
Yeah. He asked me just before he went over if I'd go over there as somebody that had a little bit of experience in operations analysis, because he wanted to expand that operation over there, based on what he had learned from his involvement with systems analysis for the past 2 years.
You were to be in charge of the operation?
Of the operations analysis group, yeah. He got there about 10 days before I did, and toured the country on a relieving type of inspection, you might call it, or familiarization
type. To whom was he directly responsible there?
The commander-in-chief of the Pacific Fleet. No, wait a minute, that's not exactly true. He was directly responsible there to General Abrams.
General Abrams.
Who was U.S. Commander of Military Assistance.
Yeah, right.
Command of Vietnam. And he was responsible on the Navy side to the Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Pacific Fleet.
But operationally, in terms of daily operations,
General
to Abrams.
He was a subordinate commander under General Abrams.
But then it was direct. There was nobody in between those
right,
two.
Right, direct. Yeah. General Brown was the other subordinate commander. He's now the chairman of the Chiefs. He heads up their force. But those were the two subordinate commanders. Now, General Abrams himself was double-hatted as head of the U.S. Army forces over there, but he had a general who was a deputy for him under for that operation, but he theoretically was head of the Army, as well as head of all U.S. forces, and his subordinate commanders were the Navy and the Air Force. But Admiral Zumwalt went on the tour of the country, and of course he did a lot of studying before he went over there. And I arrived the night before he relieved as Commander 4B. He kind of outlined the three things that he thought were his mission during his time in Vietnam. One was an operational one. He wanted to get to get into the Delta a lot more and to utilize our resources, the Vietnamese Navy resources, to get back control of a lot of the canals and little tributaries that the Viet Cong still had control of since the Tet of 68 offensive. And the second major area was also operational. There was one military territory that came under the Vietnamese Navy. It's called the Rung Sot Special Zone, which is kind of a mangrove swamp area just south and east of Saigon. The importance of that, the reason it belonged to the Navy is because it's mostly water. It's really swampy. But the importance of that area is that the main shipping channel for shipping up to Saigon goes right through that swamp. Mm-hmm. Traditionally, Rung Sot, I guess, stands for Forest of the Assassins or something like that. Been a lot of pirating, a lot of activity against shipping through the centuries carried on in this swampy area. And he wanted to do a better job of keeping control, of helping the Vietnamese Navy keep control of that area to avoid any attack on shipping going up to Saigon. The third thing that he wanted to do was figure out a way, as fast as he possibly could, of turning over our assets to the Vietnamese, because he saw the United States Navy, and of course you can say the same thing about the other services, but we're only talking about the Navy right now, having a lot of their money diverted to the Vietnam War, and we were not in the business of a lot of the new construction that we should have been in the business of to keep up which was already a growing Soviet fleet. Mm-hmm. Now, we've talked a lot about what the Soviets have done the last 5 years in modernizing their fleet, but it's been going on for about the last 15 or 20
years.
He
was concerned about it back then.
And he was very much concerned about that. He saw them building, and he saw us with almost a zero, with a couple exceptions, of building program, or new construction or modernization program, because a lot of money was being diverted to Vietnam. And he felt one way to get out of that was to get the Vietnamese to pick up the load so that they could handle the thing themselves, and at least on the thing that he had a responsibility for, namely the inshore and riverine forces, that we ought to be able to turn that operation entirely over to Vietnamese Navy.
Now,
so those were his three big missions.
Now, when you say he had three big missions when he took over...
Or objectives.
Or objectives, yeah. When he took over in Vietnam. How does this work in the military? Were they also Abrams' objectives? Were they also the Secretary of the Navy's objectives? Had he checked them around before he... were they his predecessor's objectives, or did they differ from his predecessor's objectives? How does... in other words, how does innovation happen? If there was innovation in this, how does it occur?
I think an innovative officer in the Navy, and I suspect in any organization, when he comes to a new job, kind of evaluates the new job and then makes a determination of what are the key areas that I can make the most impact on the accomplishment of this job by pursuing.
Yeah.
Now, the other kind of officer is one who comes aboard and says, what have you done before and what do I do each month, and continues to maintain the status quo. But a person like Admiral Zumwalt, unfortunately we have some like that, come, and when they get a new job, they take a look to see what are the areas that I ought to really put my emphasis into.
Now, these three things
And these
were
the things that he decided.
They were about. Something new?
In the manner, in the emphasis was new.
Was the Vietnamization part of it new altogether, or was that just emphasis too?
It was a huge emphasis. Let me tell you about that, because that's where I'm going to spend most of my time on. That's what I know the most on. There was in existence a 5-year program for modernization and improvement of the Vietnamese Armed Forces. And the Navy portion of that was a modest turnover of some of the facilities that we had over a 5-year period.
Facilities being bases and boats, both?
Most boats.
Just boats.
Not much talk about any bases. Mostly boats. He, after about, right after he got there, he started talking about, we've got to accelerate this, we've got to do a better job. Sometime around the 20th of October, or something about that time frame, it turned out that there was a routine presentation to General Abrams that had been called for on the programs that the various services had for complying with this 5-year turnover program. Admiral Zumwalt asked us to put together something far more ambitious than this thing that we would have done as a routine measure, because everybody had his program. It was a 5-year thing, and it did involve certain milestones and this sort of thing. And the people who were putting it together were putting together slides and a formal presentation to support this thing that was a very routine, well-known thing. He wasn't satisfied with it. He said, it's nowhere near fast enough. I really want this accelerated. You don't understand what I'm talking about. Really, really pull out the stops and make something that's just as fast as we can go. And he asked me to get involved in that. So over one weekend, I got all my people together in the systems analysis group there. And I sat down and wrote some skeletons out. I talked to, Lord, I didn't even know what the Vietnamese Navy looked like. This is, I don't even know that for a week.
This was right, and right at the beginning.
And I'd never been on any of those little craft or anything like that. And
you hadn't toured the country.
I did not know anything about the Navy in Vietnam. My experience was submarining. And that's, and one tour in Washington with him, and I was in the strategic offensive and defensive analysis business. And so I, you know, that's about as far as you could possibly get from a little boat on a river in the Delta Mekong. Yeah. And that's probably helpful that I really didn't know anything about the Vietnamese Navy. So all I was doing was dealing with figures that somebody was giving me. I had met a couple of Vietnamese officers, and I realized that they were a real talented professional group, and so I assumed that they had the nucleus of a real fine group of people that could pull something off. Then I'd met the CNO, Admiral Chan, then Commodore Chan, and that was about it. So I made up kind of a skeleton of an outline, and then I got all of our people, and I got the facts from the other parts of the staff that knew what the relative sizes of the two navies in the country were, and so forth. And our people worked just about all night long for about 48 hours, and we came up with some sort of a program that we put together in slide fashion. Never did write any script or anything like that. So this is now around about Monday, and we showed it to the boss, and that was the kind of thing that he was after. So he did an awful lot of, well, okay, add this to it, and put another slide in here on this, and you got too much emphasis here, cut that way down, this sort of thing. And we kept massaging the thing until Thursday, which is now something like about the 31st of October. And that's when we would make the presentation to General Abrams. I'm spending a lot of detail on this because it's very significant. In the meantime, on about Monday or Tuesday of that week, General Abrams was called back by President Lyndon Johnson to talk to him. And President Johnson told General Abrams, the only way out of this is to turn it over to the Vietnamese. And you're not, the program you've got laid out now is not fast enough. Said, I'm proud of you. I think he wrote him a letter and he gave it to him. And Abrazone can give you all this, fill in here. But with such words in it as, Lincoln had his Grant, and I had my Abrams, and this kind of thing. But I want you to get that thing turned over to the Vietnamese. And so, on Thursday, we went over for the presentation, and Admiral Zumwalt was going to give it. All he had was copies of the slides that we had with his own notes made on each slide, just cryptic notes. We'd practiced it a couple of times, and we went over to the MACV headquarters, which was the little Pentagon East, or whatever you want to call it, and were at the room where they made all the briefings and presentations to General Abrams and his staff. And we practiced it once more there. Then it was time for the Air Force's presentation of their program. And Admiral Zumwalt stayed there to in the background there to listen to the Air Force's presentation. Commander Parent, who worked for me, he's got really new systems analysis, and he was kind of right-hand man to me, and this guy that was helping me put this presentation together. He and I were in the back flipping the slides, Commander to Carrot. Well, we also decided to stay there and listen to the Air Force's presentation. So what I'm telling you is heard from behind a screen. The Air Force guy, he couldn't get two sentences out before he'd get interrupted. And I really felt sorry for this presenter. And to the point that finally, the fist comes down on the table and you hear ashtrays bounce and you hear really quiet out there for a microsecond before General Abrams starts talking. And he really chewed out the Air Force for no imagination. What we want is a greatly accelerated program. You've got to pull out the stops, use some imagination, and all this sort of thing. And come back in 2 weeks with a program like I'm talking about right now, not with that trash you'd be trying to show me today. Well, Admiral Zumwalt told us later that when everybody got up from the table and General Abrams walked out, the chief of staff came up to him and said, Bud, in view of what happened, you want to just go ahead and delay yours and come back in 2 weeks? And Admiral Zumwalt, knowing him, I know he was smiling inwardly, said, oh no, we'll go ahead and go on. Well, he came back to us. Now, I've heard him tell this story recently, and he tells a different version than I do. He says we had two different presentations. A slow pace and a fast pace. I don't remember putting together any slow pace, but what I do remember is that we had about a third or a half of the presentation showed a lot of history and a lot of what had been done and what was going to be done, and then we had the last half of it that showed our proposed program. And he came back and he said, okay, we're going to move real fast from here to here, and we're just going to just put them on and take them off, and I'll just say a few words, and then when we get into what our proposal is, we'll kind of relax and dwell on that. And that's precisely what he did. And he started off, God, he was going so fast that Leo and I could hardly keep up with the slides. And all of a sudden he got to the new program, and he started really dwelling in on this. He talked for 30 minutes without a single interruption. And when he got done, it was complete silence, maybe for 30 seconds or a minute or something like that. It seemed to me a long time. And then one by one, the staff, General Abrams, would say, well, yes, but. And after about the second or third yes, but, down came the fist again. I like it, and we're going to try to support you with that. That's what I want.
And a bad start.
And Admiral Zumwalt's response to that was, and this is Thursday, General, by Monday morning we'll have a completely staffed plan on your desk. So, all of our people worked overnight for 4 more days, and what we put together, and unfortunately I do not have this document anywhere, but what we put together was a letter with something like 12 enclosures that described the plan that we had presented, that contained a series of letters and messages and so forth to notify higher authority, to seek a few resources for some of the things that we needed to do, and this kind of thing. Sort of implementing documents that really and truly all, they were in such a form that all General Abrams would really have to do is sign his name about 8 or 9 times and let him go, and it would be on the way. As it turned out, he gave it to his staff to staff, even though he wanted to support it. Obviously, you know, he gave it to his staff to work with. And it was the 18th of November that the message finally went out.
That's pretty quick, though, right?
Oh, God, that's unbelievable. Yeah. Absolutely unbelievable. And before the end of the year, we had in operation a school that would take something like 300 young Vietnamese at a time, recruits, right out of recruit training. And it was a combination of teaching them English, it was a 3-month school, and a little bit of knowledge on how to operate in one of our small fiberglass boats called PBRs. This school we called the Boat School, and we set it up.
Why did you need to teach them English?
Because the scheme, let me back up. What we were going to have to do to get them to take over our craft, and we were talking something upwards of turning over 500 craft. As it turns out, when you counted up all the little Boston whalers and all the logistics support craft and everything, including our combat craft, we turned over, roughly speaking, 1,000 craft for them to operate, most of which they had no experience with whatsoever. Now, with their Navy having to grow at the rate at which it was going to have to grow to do this, there was insufficient capacity to get them through all of the basic training schools and get them into some sort of system where they, on their own, would train the people to operate some of these craft. For example, we were turning over eventually 250 of these PBRs. And so we figured that the best way to do this, and this was part of the plan that we put together that nobody thought was going to work, we decided what we would do is train them in our crews. And the way we would do that is we'd bring a Vietnamese young man into the crew, only 4-man crews.
Oh, I see.
And we'd bring the Vietnamese man in and make it 5 for a while, and he would stay there and pick up his knowledge and capability in relieving the junior man on there. And then we'd kick the U.S. guy off, and we'd have 1 Vietnamese and 3 U.S. And then we'd bring another Vietnamese aboard, and he would learn, and then we'd get rid of another U.S., and so forth, till the Vietnamese had the whole boat.
It's easier to teach 1 Vietnamese English than 4 Americans Vietnamese.
And that turns out to be the case. I started in the other direction. Before we put this thing together, in that 2 or 3 week period I had before we spent the weekend putting a plan together, I knew that we were going to have a program to teach Vietnamese how to operate our craft in some way. Admiral Zumwalt had decided that he wanted to do it kind of on the job training. And I originally pursued the idea of teaching, you know, whole-scale teaching of us Vietnamese. It turned out to be easier to do a whole-scale teaching of the Vietnamese English.